The Guardian. Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
So, the new era begins, for UK politics at least, and one thing that everyone agrees is it's going to be tough. Another thing most right-minded people would probably agree is that there is no longer any single reliable narrative. With the uncanny knack that's the preserve of the novelist, Blake Morrison was onto that one. He joins us to explain why he chose the most unreliable of narrators for his new novel. And we take a step back from the quirks of the UK's political landscape to look at the one narrative that does seem to be unfolding with horrifying inevitability, the threat posed by climate change to the future of the human race. Nowhere is the last post sounded more clearly than in Requiem for a Species by the Australian big thinker Clive Hamilton, who joins us later. But first, here's Blake Morrison reading from the opening chapter of his eerily titled novel, The Last Weekend.
You know how it is with friends. The closer you get, the less you see them for what they are. They suck you in, they drag you down. You resist, but their allure's too strong. Choked by their needs, you cease to see how mad they are. Or perhaps you see it from the start, but choose to ignore it out of love. Or the madness lies dormant until the chemistry between you sets it off. Who can say, I've only my own experience to go on. The one thing I have learned is this. When people accuse you of harbouring negative feelings, anger, jealousy, malice, resentment, it's they who are feeling them. I dare say there's a technical term for it, a shrink word. But you have to be there, enfolded in someone's weirdness, to know what it's like.
Blake Morrison, reading from The Last Weekend. And Blake joins me here in the studio. Blake, there's a rather lovely ringing phrase from that opening chapter, which is enfolded in people's weirdness. That seems to sum up a lot of it for me.
Yes, I mean, I wanted that feeling gradually to creep over the reader without giving too much away. The narrator is this chap called Ian. He's a primary school teacher. He comes across with a kind of blokish normality. He's trying to set the record straight, tell you a story of something that's happened to him. And I wanted the reader initially at least to feel, on Ian's side. But gradually this, I think, yes, a strangeness, a weirdness develops in the novel.
Mm-hmm. So you have two couples here. There is also there are some other characters, but the central relationships are between Ian and his partner who work in the estate sector, and then the more glamorous, better born, in Ian's view, Ollie and Daisy. He's a barrister and she's a sort of works with artists.
Headhunter, yeah.
So you're setting up something which says something about the class system, aren't you?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, if you like, at one point when they're at university, Ollie and Ian are sort of supposed to be on level ground. They're studying the same subject. In fact, already there's this huge gulf between them. Of course, Ian's telling the story, and one has to be a little bit sceptical about Ian and what he says about his background and how proletarian he is. But yes, I think there are differences, and partly this is a novel about envy, and certainly Ian kind of owns up to that from the start, that he envies the rather glamorous, successful lifestyle that his old friends Ollie and Daisy have.
There's another fact. Of course, I'm reading this with the election looming over me, and I could see that one might read it differently in 6 weeks' time. But it did strike me very forcibly that here you have the state sector workers who are in a barren marriage, basically, and you have the rather glamorous couple who have a dysfunctional child. Does this really irritate you when people read your fiction with this sort of meaning going around their heads?
Delights me. Delights me that you can find meanings in it that I hadn't been conscious of. The state v private thing hadn't occurred to me, but you're absolutely right about that. No, I don't think an author owns his or her own text. I mean, you hope that it takes off for other people and they find things in it that you hadn't thought of, that it reverberates and resonates in that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's in a country house. So, in fact, it's evoking resonances of the country house novel, isn't it? But it's not just any old country house. It's not a grand country house. Well, it was once, but isn't any longer.
No, it isn't. I mean, Ian thinks, Ollie and Daisy being affluent as they are, that he's bound to be going to some posh spot, some grand country mansion, but it's not at all. It's a bit run down. Ian's pretty shocked by its state at the beginning, and that makes him worry about Ollie's state as well. Yeah, I mean, it's a country house weekend novel in the country, in a house, over a weekend, but not country house. The other thing is I was quite interested in having a kind of slightly gothic atmosphere to this, and I think we always associate gothic with cold and dark and spooky. And so there was the challenge of making something set on a very hot summer's weekend, nonetheless have a gothic, spooky atmosphere.
And the central thing in it is probably the competitiveness between these two old friends and the viciousness that it brings out in them.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell me whether this is just a male thing, but, you know, rivalry is deeply embedded in a lot of people I know, mostly men. Ollie and Ian have an old bet. They say it's no big deal, it's just a bit of a laugh, a bit of fun, but actually they're hugely competitive. And, you know, maybe I did have something in mind here about what a competitive society we have become, and indeed what a betting culture we've become. And, yeah, that's part of the narrative too, I guess.
It also enables you to have some rather nice set pieces, like the golf scene.
Yeah, the golf scene. You wouldn't necessarily expect me to write a scene with golf.
I was going to say, are you a golfer, Blake?
I have been known to play. My dad used to play with me. My son, having grown up watching Tiger Woods, doesn't have that feeling about golf, that it's sort of posh and exclusive activity. But I did think, you know, to write a novel in which there's a scene with golf in it, and indeed a couple of scenes set around dinner tables, dinner party chat, you know, you had to work very hard to have a narrative pull, to get away with writing about that kind of material. But yes, there are set pieces because there's a contest between these guys, and there are effectively three contests that they have to have before the end of the novel. And I've always quite liked that in a novel reading where there's a game, there's a competition, who's going to win? You just get sucked into that, and I hope the readers would too with this.
Mm. And it's this wonderful way of demonstrating without actually telling what the way the relationship works, isn't it? There's an awful lot can hang on the arc of a golf ball.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about men in my experience playing sort of gentle tennis games, as I sometimes do, is that, you know, you get two men who don't know each other very well or haven't seen each other a long while, and they're about to play something, and one they'll each tell the other that they're out of practice, that they're rubbish at this game, that anyway it's just a bit of fun, and then in the event it'll become vicious.
Mm-hmm. Now, I opened by mentioning the unreliable narrator, and I just think that that's a really great figure for our time. It is the figure of our time, really, isn't it? This is a man who's addicted to gambling but doesn't own up to it, doesn't even think he is. He's possibly sexually violent. There are all sorts of things that we don't absolutely know because he doesn't know.
The things that we gradually find out, I mean, one of my challenges was at what point to release certain bits of information or to allow Ian to admit to certain things. And he sort of tries to be on the level he pretends with his reader, but actually there are some things he leaves it till very late on to reveal about himself. Yeah, I hate to use the U word, the unreliable.
Do you? That's a bad word, is it?
Well, it's because, I suppose, two things. One is, I don't really want people to start reading this novel with that word looming in their heads.
Yeah.
But secondly, because there are all kinds of different kinds of unreliable narrator, I think. You know, there are people who deliberately lie, but then there are people who lie to themselves, who are self-deluded. And I think Ian perhaps is more in the second category, you know, that he believes at some level a lot of what he's telling the reader, but the reader becomes gradually suspicious.
Now, I remember once I interviewed you at Hay, and it was when your novel The South of the River came out, and I think you balked at being described as a State of the Nation novel.
It sounded a bit grandiose and pretentious, and so on. Now I'm very happy to for it to be considered State of the Nation.
That particular one.
Yeah, because that one, I think, you know, it was set on a large scale, and it did begin on May the 2nd, 1997, after an election, and although none of the characters is particularly political, there was the political backdrop of the Blair years, the early Blair years. I don't think of this one as State of the Nation. I think of this as small and inward, really, and psychological more than anything. But, you know, it's set in contemporary Britain, and perhaps there will be some sort of political resonance for some readers.
Mm. Well, I mean, there's a huge amount of class anger in it, isn't there? It's like the baby boomer generation and the grammar school generation who haven't achieved the glittering prizes.
Mm. You know, I had a grammar school education, and I think that one thing that gave you, perhaps unfortunately really, you were always being told, you know, how many marks you got and the next person, what they got in a particular Latin test or whatever. And so you're hugely conscious of each other's position in relation to each other. And if you add that into the sort of pressures that now exist in this hugely competitive society of ours, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are quite eaten up. You know, it's sad that this should be the case, but I think it is.
The Last Weekend is published by Chatto & Windus, and Blake points out it's pleasingly cheap at £12.99. Blake had the luck or judgment to be published on Election Day. That's today as we record this podcast. So what other books might be relevant to this new era? Joining Blake and me to discuss it are Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website, and the editor of Guardian's Saturday Review, Lisa Allardyce, who has spent her election week pestering the great and the good for the books they think we should all be reading. Lisa, will you please explain to us what people have come up with and who you've asked?
Well, there was a general theory that people might be electioned out, which possibly they will. But as time went on and it looked as if there really was going to be significant change and whatever happens, we will be in a changed world, we thought it would be fun to do one of those literary parlour games asking the great and the good what reading lists they would give for the incoming government. So we tried politicians, economists, environmentalists, just to come up with some seminal texts to lead them on their way. Will Self was his usual self, and he recommends Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London. As an ex-public school boy, he, the new Prime Minister, may find it easier to empathise with an old Etonian on the skids. Alternatively, Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier gives a journalistic, if still convincing, portrayal of what life is like for working class deprived of both work and a social safety net.
Is Will, do you think, maybe prejudging the result of the election?
He also says the Prime Minister must have some sympathy for all the non-doms and oligarchs who are hitting the skids, poor lambs. He should read, or dare I say reread, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. Others were slightly more serious. Mary Beard gives a plea for preservation of universities and museums. She says that Tacitus' Annals is the sharpest analysis of political corruption, ancient or modern, that she's ever read. She urges them to read The Divine Comedy, Remembrance of Things Past and Faust, but in Italian, French and German respectively, as a reminder of the importance of modern language teaching. John Gray recommends On Liberty. But my favourite, I think, is Michael Holroyd, the biographer, who says that as he watched Brown and Cameron and Clegg on telly, I longed for one of them to break free from triviality and statistics. And he suggests that they read Boswell's journals to see how badly he behaved and then reflect on why we nevertheless love him.
Sarah, now there's a stonking great reading list for you. Do you think in a period of cutbacks and austerity, what people want is to read improving literature? I mean, do we want to read Down and Out in Paris and London?
I think there's always a place for Down and Out in Paris and London, and there's always a place for Will Self. I think that pretty much whoever gets in, we're looking at a new age of austerity. That seems to be the bottom line that everyone's pushing. If you look back at other periods of great economic downturn in history, often they produce really amazing literature. So, for example, the Great Depression gave us Steinbeck, Of Mice and Men, and The Grapes of Wrath, which is probably the Great Depression novel, Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, Brave New World from Aldous Huxley, and Patrick Hamilton's 20,000 Streets Under the Sky. And these are all great books. And then you also had the poets of the time in Britain, the pylon poets, Auden and Cecil Day Lewis and Stephen Spender, coming out with this kind of gritty industrial realist, modernist, I suppose, poetry. So it's possible that we'll actually come out of this with some great art to show for it. So that might be a positive spin that we could
do. Do you
on
feel,
things.
Blake, as a novelist, do you feel challenged by it or depressed by it? Or is it relevant to you as a writer of fiction?
I'm looking forward to a period of opposition instead of feeling compromised as I have for the last 10 years. But one of the things I think people are going to want in this period of austerity is comedy. So I'm going to send them back to King James's Lucky Jim because it's funny, because it's set during that austere post-war period, and also because of his taxation theory. You might remember Jim Dixon says, you know, if one man's got 10 buns and another man's got one bun, who do you take the bun from? Which always seems to me the best argument for why the rich are the ones who should be taxed. I'd want people maybe to look at Hard Times again, to remind themselves Dickens's Hard Times, what hard times can be like. Also, I think some poetry. Derek Walcott has a line that goes something like, the only nation is the imagination. And I quite like that idea, looking beyond one's nation and its health to the imaginative.
It's interesting that we're all looking quite far back, and obviously it's part of the nature of this sort of discussion. Is there stuff that's happening now that we're going to be seeing more of? Performance poetry, for example, is it going to be good for people who get up? I mean, people are going to be angry, aren't they?
Well, yes. I mean, I suppose you think back to Thatcher years. It was a great time for stand-up comedy. people found different ways to express themselves. If they felt disenfranchised from the mainstream expression, so you find more subversive modes of expression, I suppose. So, yeah, things like performance poetry, more niche things like that. But then we're also, in terms of media, we're in a very different world from the one that we were in under the last Conservative government. We have the internet and we have all sorts of outlets for our feelings, you know, even just if you've been following the election, the way in which that's played out online, in blogs, on Twitter. For literature, therefore, it sort of presents an interesting new challenge of where do we put our feelings about this new regime.
Lisa, you have a bit of a vested interest in literature continuing not being debased to the level of tweets, don't you?
I do.
Are you hopeful?
Of course, I am hopeful. I mean, I would like to suggest two books that I would recommend for the incoming government. The first, I think anybody should read Middlemarch, published in 1874, but set just before the Reform Bill of 1832. Virginia Woolf called it one of the few English novels written for grown-ups, and I think that still stands. Its themes, education, education for women, medical and political reform, and in particular debt and the dangers of borrowing too much money, are obviously all pertinent. Mainly, I think I'd recommend it because Eliot's such a moral writer, not in the sort of Tory back-to-basics, tax breaks for marriage. Of course, Eliot was very controversial in Living in Sin with George Lewis, but mainly because she's just such a human and humanist writer, and I think she's a good moral touchstone.
I'm going to chip in at this point and pick up Blake's point about comic novels, and I'm going to put in a little plea for Cold Comfort Farm, Stella Gibbons. So I guess you're a bit of a fan, aren't you, Sarah?
Yes, yes, I love it. And I love the fact that it projects into the future as well as giving us the reassurance of the past. I really like that side of it, the way it's all set on farms and sort of 1930s setting, but then, you know, there are flying machines and that kind of thing. I think it's brilliant. And also, I completely agree with Lisa about Middlemarch. And what I take from it as a novel, and it's something that I think that we could really do with right now, is that even though it goes into the absolute depths of kind of personal ruin and financial ruin, the elections and marriages breaking down and all of that, you still get the sense at the end of it that if she's not talking about a benign universe overall, she's talking about a universe where the number of benign people outweigh the number of malign people, and that it feels like an incredibly sort of enriching book to read, and that maybe is something that we could use right now.
It's also, of course, a great lesson on the dangers of self-delusion and extreme idealism.
Here we come back to The Last Weekend. Very neat.
I recently reread Middlemarch, and I'm totally supporting this argument. It's also a great novel and about empathy and, you know, developing empathy. Well, that's one of George Eliot's big lines. I just make a plea before Lisa mentions her second book for poetry, you know, in this new era. Auden, I think, is somebody to turn to at a time when maybe we're feeling bleak about what's happening out there. The idea that certain things never change, or certain things are not affected by bleak social change. So that, you know, in Musée des Beaux-Arts, that famous poem about, you know, the fall of Icarus not affecting the ploughmen or children playing at the edge of a town who did not especially want it to happen, and vast herds of reindeer altogether elsewhere. This idea of the altogether elsewhere that's untouched by the political world, I think it's good to remember that.
Lisa, your second book.
My second book is a non-fiction book. I think it probably weighs in about the same size as Middlemarch, which is impressive. It's The Bridge by the New Yorker editor-in-chief David Remnick. And I think given the special relationship that an incoming PM should really get to know what makes Barack Obama tick. In Pankaj Mishra's contribution to our reading list for the future, he says that Obama's serene indifference to British politics makes the special relationship look rather like unrequited or at least misplaced love. But I think it doesn't entirely show Obama as a saintly figure, but it does show how he works. It shows what an incredible negotiator he is. It shows that real political change, which has become one of the leitmotifs and watchwords of the election campaigns for all three parties, it shows that real political change is possible. And most importantly, it shows what a sort of wonderfully literate and literary leader the American president is, which I think is something any new government should take heart from.
I'm afraid that's the extent of the glad tidings on this particular podcast. One thing this election has brought out is our need to be told the truth about how bad things are going to be, And if the politicians have been reluctant to spell it out on the campaign trail, the Australian author Clive Hamilton has no such reticence. His new book is called Requiem for a Species. It's about our willingness to avoid unpleasant facts and the consequences of these failures, not in a far distant future, but within our own lifetimes.
We've never really believed the dire warnings of the scientists. Unreasoning optimism is one of humankind's greatest virtues and most dangerous foibles. Primo Levi quotes an old German adage that encapsulates our psychological resistance to the scientific warnings. Things whose existence is not morally possible cannot exist. With the growth of global greenhouse gas emissions now exceeding the worst-case scenarios of a few years ago, and the expectation that we'll soon pass tipping points that will trigger irreversible changes to the climate, it's now apparent that the Cassandras, the global warming pessimists, are proving to be right, and the Pollyannas, the optimists, wrong. In the Greek myth, Cassandra was given the gift of prophecy by Apollo. But when she failed to return his love, Apollo issued a curse so that her prophecies would not be believed. I think the climate scientists, who for two decades have been sending warnings about global warming and its impacts, must sometimes feel like Cassandra's cursed by Apollo, and never more so than now.
Clive Hamilton reading from Requiem for a Species. Earlier this week, he came into The Guardian to talk to Richard Lee.
The email hacking scandal, the disaster at Copenhagen, the world recession have all pushed climate change down the agenda, but the science hasn't changed. What kind of world are we looking at in 20, 50 or 100 years' time?
Well, you know, there was a very important but somewhat neglected conference in Oxford last October, where for the first time some of the world's leading climate scientists gathered together to consider a previously inconceivable scenario, and that is a warming this century of 4 degrees centigrade or more. Now, 4 degrees centigrade would make the Earth hotter than it's been for 15 million years. It would transform the conditions of life on Earth. It would, as one of the scientists said at the conference, reweave the web of life. And yet these scientists believe that we are likely to reach 4 degrees above pre-industrial levels by perhaps the 2070s, and in fact we will be lucky, according to the best analysis, if we limit warming to that. And of course 4 degrees is not some stationary point we reach, because if the Earth does warm to 4 degrees, which now seems somewhere between likely and inevitable, 4 degrees will simply be a point through which we pass on the way to something barely conceivable. So the situation is beyond grim. It really is at a point where we have to consider the future of civilization. As I say in the book, environmentalists have systematically understated the threats to the world from climate change for fear of scaring people too much. But I think now fear is the only rational sensation.
But why is it that only 26% in a recent poll of UK population actually believe that climate change is happening and that it's man-made?
Well, it is truly astonishing, and it's been quite shocking for many of us who've been involved in writing about and analysing climate change for 15, 16, 17 years in my case, that as the scientific evidence becomes stronger and stronger, particularly over the last year or so, popular support for strong action on climate change has softened in this country, in my country, in Australia, and in the United States. So a huge gap has opened up between the facts as presented by climate science and popular perceptions and government resolve. And I think the reason for this is that at its heart, people would prefer not to believe that the climate is changing and that we're headed for a very unpleasant future. I mean, who wants to believe? I don't want to believe that. So if someone apparently credible comes along and says, look, this is a beat up, this is an exaggeration, the scientists really can't make up their minds, then many people will seize on that. They want to believe that the scientists have got it wrong. Sadly, they haven't. And it means that our response to the science, which even in the last 6 months since the so-called ClimateGate scandal broke, the science has become more alarming, and yet public perceptions have gone the other way. So we're in trouble.
And this is people's inbuilt optimism, people's inbuilt desire not to contemplate the terrible.
I think that's one of the fundamental things. Humans are wonderfully optimistic creatures. There have been a lot of studies which have shown that people will carry around illusions about themselves and the world, which actually helps us function in daily life. I mean, if we took on the slings and arrows of daily life, you know, we'd crawl up in a ball and go and hide in our bedrooms. And so human beings construct themselves and their world, and they're optimistic about it. And consistent bad news is something that people don't want to hear. And so we look for historical analogies to try and help us understand, in addition to the vast array of psychological literature. And one of the most powerful historical analogies, I think, is Britain before the Second World War. Winston Churchill, through a series of speeches beginning in 1932 in the Commons, warned the government and the people that Germany was rearming, that the Nazis had a hostile intent, and that there was no way of appeasing them. And Churchill was attacked, ridiculed, he was called an alarmist, he was told that he was like a Malay running amok, trying to alarm people for no good reason. There were movements within his constituency to unseat him. In fact, that move, because of course he was regarded very antagonistically by the Conservative government that he was so vigorously attacking in the late 1930s, and indeed as late as March 1939, there were serious moves in his constituency to kick him out, and he wrote that he would then run as an independent. This was 6 months before war broke out, and a year or 9 months before he became wartime prime minister, and yet so annoyed were people. Even in the face of overwhelming evidence of Nazi aggression in Europe, people didn't want to believe it. They were so determined that Europe could be peaceful that they would not heed the warnings and indeed turned on Churchill, who was making the loudest warnings that Britain had to rearm.
Is this realisation that climate change is dangerous and inevitable something you've had to struggle with yourself?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been writing about climate change as a policy analyst and economist since about 1994. And I always recognise that we're in a bad situation. And, you know, I read the IPCC reports. I talk to climate scientists. I hear what they say in public and in private. And always their private concerns have been much more intense than the ones they express in public. But it wasn't until September 2008 when I read a couple of papers, and one in particular by two British climate scientists, Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes, who set out just what an awful situation we confront. They carried out an analysis, very cool, numerical analysis, which showed even under a series of optimistic assumptions about when global greenhouse gas emissions might reach their peak and the rate at which they could decline thereafter. Even with optimistic assumptions, we're still headed for 4 degrees of warming. For me, this was a very deep shock. It really knocked me about. I walked around in a semi-daze for some weeks. I thought, we're in so much trouble. And almost no one, other than a few climate scientists, really understands just how bad the situation is and how we have virtually no chance of avoiding catastrophic climate change. So it really was a big shock for me, because you have to rethink everything. We all have a conception of the future. We often don't think about it in very explicit terms. We might 1, 2, 5 years in advance planning. We might have vague plans about getting married and having children or buying a house or making progress in our careers or retiring. But we generally have this conception of the future, which is an improved version of the present. We imagine the world continuing on as it is, getting better slowly. But when you confront what the climate scientists are telling us, as they did at this conference in Oxford in October of last year, you realise that the future is not going to be an improved version of the present, but a much more dangerous and difficult world in which we're going to have to rethink pretty much everything, a world in which we're going to be constantly adapting to a transformed and, in most places, a much less friendly, indeed a hostile climate. And when you start thinking in those terms, you realise that not only personally, but as communities, as nations globally, we have to completely rethink how we plan for the future. But no one's doing that. People are just pretending that everything will be all right and it will go away.
But if you argue that climate change is really happening, that it's irreversible, that it's definitely going to be bad, isn't that almost irresponsible? Isn't it almost an invitation to despair?
Well, given the nature of the facts, I think feeling despair is the appropriate human response. I mean, what else should one feel in those circumstances? Of course, the danger is becoming trapped in despair. And that's why in the book I talk about a grieving process and what we're facing here, what sort of death are we facing over which we should grieve? We're facing the death of the future, the death of our conception of the future. I mean, climate change, once you really get into it, has a lot of mortality about it. I mean, these projections about people dying in large numbers in developing countries are not, you know, mere numbers on a page. They're the best analyses that we can do. And when we think about children born today, most of them in a country like Britain will be alive at the end of the century or close to it. And so they're going to be right in the thick of it. I mean, it's going to be a completely transformed world. And in those circumstances, despair is appropriate. But in the book, I argue that after we've despaired and felt anguish, anxiety, depression, helplessness, we have to accept that this is the new world in which we live, which will evolve in a certain way, and that we must accept that. And we must then prepare for it. That's the only thing to do.
So what should we be doing now?
Well, first of all, we have to face up to the facts. The facts as I've described them, based as faithfully as I can on a rendering of the science of the leading climate scientists. We just have to accept the type of world that they are saying we're now locked onto. That in itself is a very big task to get people to accept that, because once we do, or once a critical number of citizens do get that, then everything will change. At the moment, perhaps a few percentage of the population in countries like this do get it. They go through what's been described as an oh shit moment. You know, that point where you're travelling along, you've been reading about climate change, and you suddenly come across something and it penetrates those protective layers that we have, gets through to us, and we say, oh shit, this is serious. We're really in trouble. Once a sufficient portion of the population reaches that point and we can sweep away the objections of the denialists and the pusillanimous politicians and the people who are pathologically optimistic or pathologically hate environmentalism and therefore reject science, then we will start planning. We have to prepare to adapt. Of course, we have to mitigate. We have to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions as much as we can, as quickly as we can. But we also have to plan to adapt to a dramatically changed world in the coming decades.
What do you mean in the book when you talk about a new radicalism, which is no longer bound to submit to the laws that continue to pollute the atmosphere? Are you trying to start a revolution?
Well, if you look at the circumstances that humanity faces, it's legitimate to ask whether there have ever been circumstances where some sort of revolution were not more justified. I mean, we're talking about the survival of humanity this century. And so what we have is systems of democracy in countries like the UK and Australia and the United States, which have so far proven wholly inadequate in responding to the type of threat to our future that climate change poses. And I argue in the book that the case for civil disobedience, non-violent direct action, breaking laws, in order to pursue a greater goal of the protection of humanity and the natural environment, is fully justified ethically. And indeed, there was a celebrated case where some Greenpeace activists a year or so ago occupied Kings North power plant, caused some criminal damage, were taken to court, prosecuted, and they put the case to a jury that, yes, they caused harm, but they did so in order to prevent a greater harm, and they were acquitted. So I think citizens, when confronted with a reality like that and a powerful ethical argument like that, can understand that breaking laws which protect polluters does have an ethical justification.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Clive Hamilton. And his book, Requiem for a Species, is published by Earthscan and is available now from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. And that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Blake Morrison, Lisa Allardyce, Sarah Crown, and Clive Hamilton. In the Guardian Saturday Review, we'll of course feature that medley of voices on the books you should all be reading. And on Sunday, the Observer's new review has a four-page fiction special, plus an extract from Robert McCrum's new book, Globish. I'm Claire Armistead, and this podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.